what's going on? It's Chris Carino. This is the Voice of the Nets podcast. Today, a really just wonderful conversation with a person who you just can't help but want to spend time with. Whenever I see Roy Alibi around the arena, just a smile comes on my face. And I once talked to somebody, and we were talking about people living with disabilities and various issues in your life. And he said, you know what? It really comes down to, are you the kind of person that people want to spend time with? And you think about it. That's what it's about, right? At the end of all these interviews, I do the Jimmy Valvano thing where I say, you know, what makes you laugh, cry, think? There's something that does that for me all in one package. And that is, to me, what's considered one of the great TV shows ever made. And that's Ted Lasso. It started with a premise of here's a college football coach who then goes to coach a English football team. So it's like kind of like you think it's a one joke kind of deal. And I went in watching it thinking that's what it was going to be. And then when it turned out, you start watching it, you realize it's got all this heart and drama and it's funny as all heck. But it also makes you think about a lot of things. And also what it points out is the coaching profession, what it says about coaches. And I've gone through this now with being in the NBA for three decades and seeing various coaching changes and who makes a good coach and who makes a bad coach. A lot of times, yes, there are elements to it that are X's and O's and theories and players. But it really comes down to a coach is there to motivate people. And that doesn't mean fiery speeches. Some guys are quiet motivators. Some guys are loud motivators. Some guys do it by making you think or laugh or cry. But it's about motivating people to be the best that they can be. When I interview Jacques Bond before every game, I know that I walk away from every encounter with Jacques a better person. I feel I'm in a better mood after I talk to Jacques Bond. The author, John Gordon, who's a motivational author, he writes these books, and one was about the energy bus. And he talked about there are certain people that are energy givers, and then there are energy vampires. And there's a lot of people, I think, that are in between. You don't want to be an energy vampire where you suck the energy out of a room. The greatest coaches are energy givers. In whatever method or whatever personality they have, Jacques Vaughn is an energy giver. Roy Alibi is an energy giver. You'll get a really good sense of his background and maybe how he got to be that way with this interview. I learned a lot about Royale and also the fact that he was not this heavily recruited basketball player in high school. That really he came to basketball late. It wasn't his reason for choosing his school and end up going to play at Cardozo with Ron DeClario. He worked for everything he's had. And he had a lot of things out there that he could have done and could have gone after. And basketball was the thing that he did. He's going to talk about what it's like to coach superstars and how maybe they need it more than anybody else. His time with Jacques Vaughn, his time at Texas, what it was like to guard Carmelo Anthony in the Final Four. And just, you know, what it is to be on this staff with the Nets and what is his day-to-day responsibilities are. So a lot of really good stuff. Enjoyed this conversation. I hope you do too. And you're also going to get the origin of his name, by the way. So here it is. Royale Ivy with me, Chris Carino, here on The Voice of the Nets. Are you a football fan? You looking forward to the games today?
My G-men are out, so.
So that's it.
Yeah, I'm a watch, but I'm definitely, you know, I'm a fan of football, so I'm a watch for the, you know, just to watch another game, but I have no pieces in play.
I am just so glad that the Cowboys didn't win last week, because then I think I might not have watched the Eagles-Cowboy game.
For sure, I'm definitely not a Cowboy supporter, and I'm ditto with that same kind of feeling. I'm not interested in any Cowboy or Cowgirl activity.
Well, Cowboys Eagles to go to the Super Bowl is just something I just don't want to experience. I don't want either one of those teams to go to the Super Bowl, and it would just be a
Well, I'm actually pulling for San Fran because Shanahan. I went to school with him, so he was a wide receiver while I was at Texas, and you know he was a good dude while in school. So
Oh, wow.
I'm pulling for Kyle and the 49ers.
So as we record this, we don't know what happened yet. So when people are listening to this, there may already be a Super Bowl matchup right now. So Shanahan was, you went to Texas with him. How well did you know him? Was he a?
You know, he was a good acquaintance. You know, we didn't hang out all the time. We were in the same similar circles. You know, he was tight with Chris Sims. I knew Chris Sims, Roy Williams. So, you know, we ran into each other throughout the years. I wouldn't say he was like, you know, one of my best buds, but definitely.
But did you ever think like this guy could end up being one of the best coaches in the NFL one day?
Whoever thinks that.
College kids don't think about that stuff.
Nah, right? We weren't thinking about that. We were thinking about our next meal. So, you know. but for sure, you know, he's definitely one of the, you know, best football brains out there, you know, as of today, you know, one of the best coaches. And he's doing a great job in San Francisco. So
you think you'd ever do you ever reach out to him? Have you ever?
I haven't. I should. I have a lot of resources that I don't really utilize. I think that's my weak point on just like utilizing my resources and reaching out to people and leaning on people. So, this new year, I think I have to, you know, tap into those resources and, you know, hit my outlets.
I think with your personality, number one, that surprises me because I think you're such an outgoing person. But also I think you have a humility about you that maybe says, I don't want to bother people. Is that part of it?
No, for sure. It's definitely, you get locked in. I think I have blinders on, especially during the season, and just the bothersome, you know, the worrisome, like, you don't want to be that person calling, asking for this, asking for that. You know, it happens day to day in my life, so I don't want to be that person. And I fall back and, you know, I just let people be where they be and stay where they stay. So I got to work on that. And that's just the human element of, you know, going through life and experiences and bettering yourself.
And you're focused. I know you coaches, especially assistant coaches, are just so focused on the next game or your next scout.
Oh yeah,
right. That you can't think about anything else.
I mean, for sure, you're watching a lot of film. You know, me having more responsibilities, watching more film. I definitely get locked into film. You know, at home, it kind of gets on my fiance's nerve. Like I'm waking up watching film. You know, I'm rewatching edits and it's just habitual now. And it's something that I love to do. And you learn new things and new nuances throughout watching film. So you get locked in and then you got to find that balance. And it's been a struggle, I must say, but you know, time management is the key and just going through it and learning from the experience is definitely helping me out in that element.
How do you watch it? Do you watch film with a notepad and you're scribbling things, or is it just any time you can get a chance you watch and it just goes into your brain somewhere?
I'm watching it. I'm rewatching things. I definitely have a pen. I have a notepad. I take notes. You know, when I see certain things, I clip when I see certain things and they go into a sorter. And then I just create a sorter throughout, you know, my process of what I like, you know, stealing plays, personnel, you know, all of that sorts. And it's just like habitual of me just taking, you know, certain actions, the frequencies, you know, if they're tweaking a play and they're running a little bit different. So I'm just looking at everything from a, you know, a bird's eye view, a different vantage point. And, you know, that's just how I kind of break it down.
And on this staff, is it how many assistant coaches are working on the scout of the next opponent?
It's different. You have your defensive scout and you have your offensive scout. So one guy's, you know, hammering the offense, one guy's hammering the defense, but we're both watching games five out. So, you know, as the season goes on and you might have a scout in between, you might be watching 10 games at a time. So it's definitely time consuming, and it's you're watching a lot of film and you get locked into just that team certain times. So, I mean, and then you got to watch the game that we play, you know, previously. So, it's a lot of film watching, so it's been good.
So it's not, because I know like in the old days used to be where there were, you know, three assistants and they would get every third game. So you guys are, everybody's on the same opponent, or is it like you have an opponent coming up in 2 days?
Yeah, I have different opponents and it switches. And okay. It's just not like rotating on a three, you know, clock guy rotation. It's like I have certain teams and those are my scouts. And when they come up on the calendar, you know, I'm knocking them out on the defensive end. So,
okay.
It's been definitely a pleasure, and then it's been eye opening.
So you're a defensive coordinator, so to speak, or assistant. And that goes back to your time as a player, and we're going to get into that in a little bit. First, let's reset now. Let's go back a little bit to the first thing that's on my mind when I want to talk to Royal Ivy is the origin of your name. Mm. All right, you have such a regal name. It's spelled like Royal. R-O-Y-A-L, mm-hmm. but it's pronounced Royale. Can you give me the background of your name?
Well, that's a great question, because people would always ask me, you know, your name looks like Royal, but it's pronounced Royale, and it's a meaning behind that. My grandfather, his full name was Roy Allen. So my mom and my dad, they're both artists, you know, and they, you know, they're outside the box thinkers. They came up with coming, putting it together and just making it Royale. And that's how they got Royale. My grandfather was the first African-American stage director in television at CBS. His name is Roy Allen. You can look him up in the Actors and Film Guild. He'll be there. And I guess it's just coincides because, you know, he was the first pioneer of, you know, his field, and I'm going down a different realm, and that's how my name came about. So it's a combination of Roy Allen to get Royale. It's Royale for short.
What was the things that your grandfather did? Like, what did he work on?
What I think one show was Good Morning America or Good Sunrise Films. Okay. I gotta get the names, but
and he was a stage. You'd say he was a stage manager.
He was a stage manager at CBS. So for a long time, for over 30 years.
And, now, is he still, was he?
No, he's no longer alive. He passed away in 94. So it's been a while.
You were young.
Yeah, I was a teenager at the time.
Did you ever get to come on the set or go see him at work or anything like that?
No, funny story. My dad used to work at CBS, so. His job, he used to put the commercials on, you know, they had somebody with all the rails and the libraries, and his job was to, you know, kind of have the scheduling of what commercial goes on what time. Yeah. And he kind of did that for some years. So my grandfather actually got him the job, but he no longer works there. He's a freelance artist. So,
artist? You said your parents are both artists?
Black and white, conceptual. They do some abstract. They do a little bit of everything. So basically, they're out there.
Now, how many brothers and sisters?
I got a younger brother. It's just me and him. So he's 5 years my junior, and he works with mental kids at risk. So he basically works at group homes.
Okay.
So
now your parents were artistic, and I guess your father worked at CBS to pay the bills, right? And you were born in Harlem, but then you guys moved to Queens.
Yeah.
How old were you when you made that move?
Wow.
You a baby?
You're going deep.
we go in depth here on the Voice of the Nets.
So I lived in Harlem to about the tender age of 9, and then we moved to Hollis, Queens. So my grandparents, had bought a house in Hollis. My mom, so I grew up in the same house my mom grew up in. So my grandparents were leaving. They were moving to Clinton, Massachusetts, and they decided to, you know, sign over the house to my mother. And, you know, I was raised in the same house as my mom in Hollis, Queens. So that's pretty unique, you know, to be raised in the same house as your mother.
When I think of Hollis, I think of Run DMC.
For sure. Run DMC, right? LL Cool J, Ja Rule, and Royale Ivy.
And a couple of good players have come out of Queens.
Oh, Lloyd Daniels. Yeah. Lamar Odom, Rafer Austin. We can go down the line. Kenny Anderson, Kenny Smith. You know, the list goes on and on of, you know, great basketball minds, great basketball players that come out the great borough of Queens.
Did you, I knew this about you as a tribute, that you were actually a Net fan as a kid.
Funny story.
Yeah. Is Kenny Anderson a part of that, or another story to that?
For sure. From New York, was never a fan of the Knicks. Was always a fan of the Nets. The Kenny Anderson, Kevin Edwards days.
Yeah, Kevin Edwards. Wow, there's a blast in the past.
Was Drazen on that team? I think.
Yeah, Drazen.
Derek Coleman. What's my guy? Chris Dudley.
Yeah, Chris Dudley. Yeah. I mean, I think Sam Bowie was on that team for a little bit. Yeah.
Those are the tie-dye uniforms, and I remember my dad taking me to my first net game, and nobody was in the arena. You know, you could basically sit anywhere you wanted. And then he became a season ticket holder. Funny, true story. You know, they did the whole transaction over the phone, and he was supposed to pay for, you know, these tickets. And he never got to that point of paying for the tickets, but we still got to go to the game. So he might owe the Nets some money.
But the statute of limitations is over on that one, Royale. Yeah, don't worry about it.
That happened in like 93. So I definitely was a fan of the Nets. Kenny Anderson was my idol growing up. Wanted to go to Georgia Tech. He was a great player on the New Jersey Nets. You know, I watched him with Steph, watched him with Jay Kidd. Like, I was definitely a fan of the Nets growing up, you know, going to the games and supporting.
I talked to Kenny for the podcast, and we talked about that year where he ended up getting hurt. Remember John Starks takes him out and he breaks his wrist? I think that was the 92-93. And man, that team was really good. And then they hit a slide after he got hurt, and they end up dropping to the four seed, and they lose to Cleveland with Daugherty and Price and that group. But man, that was such a great team.
Wasn't he an all-star with the Nets?
Yeah. Kenny, and Derek. Yeah. And Derek Coleman.
Kenny was, he was.
And Drazen.
He was one.
Think
and
about
nine.
A big three. You know, that was a heck of a big three that just, just snake bit. Right.
Yeah, and they were kind of young too. They were young.
Yeah.
So definitely a fan.
Yeah, that was your team. Yeah. Now you go to play for Ron Nicario at Cardoza High School.
Yeah.
Did you have choices, or was that just your local high school?
Well, that's the story. So my local high school was Andrew Jackson. That was my zone high school. Okay. And my mom was like, "There's no way you're going to Andrew Jackson." So I auditioned to get into Benjamin Cardoza through the dance program. So I got into the dance program.
Really?
Yeah. It's a performing.
Back door. That's how you got in.
It was, you know, it's a performing arts school, and it's math and science. They have a law program. It's pretty good. And I got in through the dance program, and I tried to drop out of dance my first year. My mom was like, "Nope, you're not dropping out of dance. That's how you got into school." So I ended up dancing at Cardoza for 4 years.
What kind of dancing?
I did modern, jazz, tap, ballet, a little bit of everything. I performed, you know.
Wow.
And it went well. It helped me with my flexibility and my agility and my, you know, just moving laterally. And playing for Nicario was different. You know, I didn't expect to play. I was going to play baseball. And really? one of my teammates, Melvin Robinson, he went to St. Peter's, was like, "Just come and try out." In my freshman year, I tried out and I got cut, like the last cut. And then my sophomore year, I came back. I grew a little bit and I made the team my sophomore year, but I didn't really play my sophomore year. But then junior year, that's when I really, you know, started to play more and gain my confidence, had my height, you know, started to kind of make a name for myself throughout the city.
So basketball was when you were younger, before high school, were you a standout basketball player or not?
No, I wasn't a standout basketball player because I did everything else. I did, you know, jujitsu. I did baseball. I did basketball. I ran track. I played tennis. I did a little bit of everything. And then I kind of, probably around ninth grade, I started to like really zero in on basketball, you know, and that was my pathway. You know, I almost didn't play basketball. If I made the baseball team, probably wouldn't be talking to me right now.
Well, it's amazing to me that you know, a lot of people would just assume that basketball was your route to Cardoza, but it was not. It was dancing.
Yeah, it was dancing.
That got you into the school, and you were going to the school not to play basketball. You're going because your mother thought it was a great school, right? Or a better school than your options were.
Yeah, for the academia. I was going for the academia, not for basketball. So,
and you know, the Cardoza has the legendary, and he's an eccentric man in Ron DeClario. He's won more games than any high school coach in New York City, and you're one of his prized players, you know, that has come out there, and it almost didn't happen.
He wouldn't tell you that, but I probably was like the diamond in the rough, like. You know, he didn't recruit me to go to Cardoza. I wasn't planning to, you know, play. It was no kind of structure built in for me to, you know, basically be a part of that program. It just happened by faith. Like, it just happened. And
you fell into his lap.
Yeah, you know,
but you had to work to get there. It doesn't seem like, you know, you got cut your freshman year or sophomore year. You barely made the team. Like, you must have had to really develop your game to get to where you were.
Yeah, I think I'm a overachiever in life. You know, people say I couldn't do this, I couldn't do that, wouldn't be here, and I just laugh at them every time and put my head down and go to work. So. That was my, you know, my mindset, you know, in high school. Just, I'm going to continue to work. I'm going to get better. I want to play. I enjoy the game. And DeClario is a great teacher. And I thank him for, you know, taking his time and really, you know, explaining and showing me the game. And I fell in love with the game, you know, throughout that process. So, he doesn't get enough credit for how he interprets the game and how he teaches the game to his, you know, students, because it's a game, you know, just like life is a game, basketball is a game, and you got to learn through experience, but you also have to have great mentors and great teachers. And he's one of the best I've ever been around, you know, at any level.
It seems like you had a lot of interests and you had a lot of paths maybe that you could have pursued and put that mindset to work. What was it about basketball in that situation that made it, that became the path for you?
I guess basketball gave me an out. It gave me an out. When I was on the court, it was like a sanctuary. Like, nothing else mattered. And the game was so pure. You got to get away from all your troubles, all the drama, all your trauma through the game of basketball. So that was my gateway. You know, just to step on the court, and, you know, that was the way I was an artist on the court, and I was free, and, you know, it gave me those liberties, and that's why I love it so much, because no matter what is going on in your life, when you step on between those lines, you have some kind of freedom for that time frame.
I know Kyrie Irving would always talk about basketball as like an art form, and I know that, you know, it has a scoreboard, so, you know, people don't really care how you get 2 points, as long as you get the 2 points. But there is a creativity about it. And, you know, you talked about being a jazz dancer. There is a looseness. There is a connection with your teammates. There is an artistry to it that will end up resulting in success.
For sure, it's an art form. I mean, whether you're a painter, like, it's a blank canvas and you get to draw or see or perceive it to how you see it in your mind. And nothing is wrong. It's all subjective of how I internalize the game. And we all internalize it a little bit different, but it's definitely it definitely has an art form, a big art form. You know, watching these guys work on their games on a daily basis is their art form. They start with the basis, the foundation, and then once they tweak the foundations and bring it up, they go into different realms with it. And it's beautiful. It's beautiful to see these guys develop and to see these guys work at it on a day-to-day basis. You know, the masses only see the end product. We deal with the day-to-day. We're in the trenches every day, you know, perfecting this or progressing this product.
You know what? Let's jump into that. I was going to save that for later, but let's jump into it now. You were a developmental coach over the years. So you know what? Let me put a pin in that. We're going to come back to that because I don't want to skip ahead to get. I want to fill in some of the blanks though before we get there with you, because I spoke to Glenn Breyka recently, the head coach at St. Francis College.
Wow.
And he said that coming out of Cardoza, it had come down, he was recruiting you, and it came down to, he thought between St. Francis and Marist, and you chose prep school. So you chose neither, and then you ended up going to Blair Academy, right? And then that got you to Texas. I guess that was another step in, you know, that makes sense to me now, knowing how late you kind of got going in high school and basketball.
And I graduated early. I graduated at 17, didn't reclass.
Okay.
So that, I guess that's my reclass, but I had later interests later in my senior year from bigger schools. Like BU was probably one of the finalists. Marist was definitely a finalist with he's at St. John's now. I can't Van Maken. He's an assistant coach at St. John's. He was recruiting me at Marist, and I was on a visit. I almost committed, and I called home to my mom, and I was like, "I'm going to Marist," and she said, "No, you're not. you didn't go on all five of your visits." And you know, I was a late bloomer. I went to work out with Naclario, and the Pitt head coach was there watching me. Ben Howland, right?
Howland, yeah.
Yeah. He offered me late, but I already gave Joe Montegna at Blair Academy my word that I was coming to Blair. So I went to prep school for a year and got the privilege of playing with Luol Deng, you know, and got a year older, a year stronger, quicker, faster, whatever you may say. And then schools like Georgia and Clemson and all Providence, these, you know, Power Five schools started coming. And in my head, I always wanted to play in the Big East, you know, but it didn't work out that way. Northwestern came in the picture with Kevin O'Neill, and I was going to take a visit there, but my SAT wasn't high enough because the academia was, you know, one of none. And prep school definitely helped me out, going to Blair Academy, playing for Joe, you know, just building the confidence, just getting stronger, just learning the game, learning myself, being in a college environment, a college setting. So my mom thought I was a little bit immature, and that's why I went to prep school, not for the basketball, but for my maturity level.
Sounds like mom had a big influence in your life, like everyone's life. But man, she made some good decisions.
Mom is an educator. So I come from a lineage of educators. My grandmother was an educator. My mom was an educator. My other grandmother was an educator. And actually my degree was in elementary education at Texas. So,
And at Texas, you got to play in a Final Four, which, you know, no offense to Marist or Northeastern or BU or St. Francis College. I don't know if you would have gotten that opportunity.
Definitely not. I was a big fish in a small pond. I mean, I was a small fish in a big pond.
Mm-hmm.
And I was comfortable with going to Texas, being that small fish in a big pond.
and you were a two-time all Big 12 defender. And I guess, you know, when you talk about, you know, your offensive numbers didn't jump off the page. Same thing when you went to the NBA, but it sounds like the way you approached everything in your life, the work ethic, overachieving kind of mentality, that's where it helps you on the defensive end of the floor. You may not always be the greatest skilled shooter or offensive player, but you can always dig in on the defensive end. Was that your mentality going to Texas?
For sure. In this game of basketball, you got to find your niche. And I found my niche early, probably in high school, even though in high school I scored a little bit more and did a little bit more. But when I got to Texas, I knew my niche, and I said, I'm going to be a defender, you know, and try to be an elite defender. And it worked, you know. I just outworked people, you know. I had a mentality like I wasn't going to be fazed. I would run through a wall. I was going to sacrifice for my teammates and do whatever I needed to do on that end. And it worked. I carved out a career in the NBA. It worked. And I went with my –
going to that Final Four, though, 2003, you guys are a one seed, and you end up losing to Syracuse in the semi. You're guarding Carmelo Anthony, right? I mean, that's the assignment you draw. I mean, Carmelo Anthony's 1 year at Syracuse might be one of the great seasons of a college player in NCAA history.
He had the greatest run. He ran through the whole Big 12, you know, like, and then he ran through. We were a number one seed, and Kansas was a number one seed, too, on the other side. They beat us. I remember guarding him. He had his career high against me. You could check the books. But he was only a freshman. I was a junior. And we joked about it because I coached Carmelo in OKC. That I was trash talking him the whole game. And he didn't say one word to me. He just smiled and just gave me bucket after bucket after bucket. And like, I'm 6'4", he's 6'8", 6'9". He's just shooting over me, going around me, just using his footwork. It was impeccable. But like, that was a heck of a run, you know, for Syracuse and Carmelo. And I just remember him just nonstop buckets.
I mean, listen, you were trying your best. You're 6'4", guarding Carmelo, and I mean, he was shooting over everybody in the country, not just you. You know, getting buckets on everybody in the country that year.
I thought I could rattle him though, but it didn't work. The trash talking end up, you know, nipping me instead of nipping him. So,
I use this when I introduce Sean Mark sometimes at different events and things, if I'm speaking, and I'll say, here's a guy who played the fewest amount of minutes in the most amount of years in NBA history. And I say, I don't mean this to be disparaging. I mean, it shows you, the kind of teammate that he was, the kind of person that you wanted in the locker room, because, you're not playing a lot of minutes, but you last for a very long time. I think you have a kind of a similar NBA career. Where, you know, you put together 10 years in a league, you played on some good teams, you had some good teammates. But there was an intangible about you that I think went beyond what you contributed in your numbers. Is that accurate to describe your NBA career?
Yeah, I would consider that very accurate. I would consider myself a glue guy, a connector. I could talk to the best guy on the team. I could, you know, typically, I was the last man on a 15-man roster, and it teetered. You know, sometimes I play, you know, sometimes I didn't play. But, you know, I had a spirit about me. Like, I was always, you know, grateful, and I show gratitude to be a part of it, because being in the NBA is a privilege, you know, and it's so much entitlement that I was thankful to wake up and to have basketball as my job. So every day I walked in, my challenge was, how can I uplift the next person? How can I push the next person? How can I inspire the next person next to me? And I didn't look at myself. I looked outside of myself to connect my teammates to the goal at hand, whether it was in OKC trying to win a finals, whether it was on a, you know, a Milwaukee team just trying to connect the dots. You know, I was willing to make that sacrifice. And it's hard, you know, being, you know, in that role. You know, you have to be a chameleon. You have to be you have to be able to adapt. And I learned how to adapt through the years and find a way how to make a team and find a way how to make a roster and find a way how to help this young guy and get through this year and uplift him. So it was definitely a challenge every year. It was a new challenge. You know, how can I affect the team in a positive light?
What was your favorite NBA moment as a player?
Ooh, it's a lot. I mean, going to the finals, getting drafted. So, I mean, I gotta, you know, sit down and really internalize that. Like, but just being a part of the journey, and you know, I look up and I played 10 years, and I was like a kid from Hollis, Queens. Nobody ever gave me a chance to ever do this. Like, you know, I'm the epitome of a overachiever, an underdog. You know, if I could do it, I feel like anybody could do it. You know, it's just like the determination and just the mindset. The mind is very powerful. Whatever you set your goals and your aspiration, your dream, like, I'm the living product of, you just got to keep on pushing through. You know, you might not like it. You got to get through the minutia. You just got to keep on pushing and pushing, and you know, you can get to it. And that's what I did.
After a game recently, Jacques Vaughn talked about, you are what you think you are. You know, you are what you put into your mind. I read a book by James Clear, Atomic Habits, and he talked about, you know, the book, right? And just, you know, if you want to be a certain kind of person, then tell yourself that you are that kind of person, and then your decisions and your actions will follow.
Yeah, we manifest our own destiny. So whatever thoughts we manifest, we become. So your thoughts are very powerful, and people don't think that. So you got to be careful with your words and your thoughts, and you got to cherish those and hold those dear, because what you think, you manifest. And that's the truth. That is a real truth. And I agree at the utmost. Like, we got to be careful with our intentions and how we think.
The way you described your playing days, was that kind of a natural transition then to being an assistant coach, and especially the way you started kind of being a developmental coach as an assistant? It seems like a lot of the things that you were doing as a player are things that you would then end up doing as a developmental coach and working with players.
Yeah, I think that's just on top of my personality. That's who I am as a person. Like, I think I'm very personable, and you know, I just like people. I like all kinds of people. I like learning from people. I like engaging with people. You know, I like having conversation with people and seeing how people are, their mental, you know, how they think, how they feel. Like, it's just diving deeper and learning that person, the ins and outs. You know, it's just like, we're all connected. We're all one, you know, and we got to help each other, and we got to pick each other up. And that's the developmental part. Is I like the developmental piece of not just the player, but the person on and off the court. We get so caught up with the concept of, oh, developmental coaches, they just, you know, workout guys. No, it's more than that. It goes way deeper into that, because you got to learn that person inside and out, how that person ticks, and, you know, what that person doesn't like, what this person weaknesses or strengths. And we got to develop the person, not just the player. You know, we got to get intact with that person's heart and, you know, what he's been through throughout life, you know, and you got to dissect that person. And that's how you get the most out of your players, by learning the person first before the player.
I could tell how passionate you are about that, because you're literally pounding the table as we
I'm passionate about people, man. We give up on people, you know, way too early. You know, we're all flawed as individuals, and you know, the beauty about life is just love. Like, we got to show more love and empathy towards each other, you know, to like build. Once we have that, we can do whatever. We can do whatever in this life, in this human body form.
You've been connected to really great players. I mean, obviously Kevin Durant. Now you're coaching Kyrie Irving. This approach you're talking about, some people think that maybe the great players don't necessarily need coaching. But how do you approach developing players that are all-time players and helping them get better?
They need it the most. I mean, because people look at these guys as mega stars, but they're human beings. Like, that's at their core. So I understand they're good players, but good players go through, you know, they go through pain, they go through uncertainty, they go through, they got to pay taxes. Like, they go through anything a regular person has to go through. So, you know, we put them off to the side. We hold them on this pedestal, but they suffer the same things as a normal person suffers. So you got to be intact and help them navigate through life, you know, the off the court things, you know, sitting them down when they're going through something and having real talk, you know, and challenging them, you know, saying, no, we need to do it this way, you know, or collaborating with them and asking them their input on certain situations. So it's all a collective, you know, and just, you know, having that connection on a day-to-day basis, you know, as a human versus just the basketball aspect, it just goes way deeper.
You went through a coaching change this year, which is always traumatic on a staff, and yet you stuck around and you're with Jacques. Your personality is a lot like Jacques in terms of you light up a room. You've always got a smile on your face. The things you're talking about are very similar, I think, to what Jacques is all about. What have you learned from this experience in being with Jacques Vaughn?
I learned a lot. I mean, I'm learning every day. Like, this experience is one of none. It's been a great experience, you know, definitely to work for a guy of JV's, you know, stature. I think he's very humble. His approach to the game, how he communicates to his players day in, day out, that's a big thing. You know, I think he's great at that. The humility is at an all-time high, but the accountability is definitely there. Just watching him, just the intricate ways how he moves the room, how he's engaging, how he's passionate, how he's detailed, and how he doesn't get rattled. There's no situation too big for him. He's always poised. His poise, his delivery, you know, his calmness,
very straightforward, right?
Yes,
like he's very direct. He doesn't waste a lot of time.
No fluff. I call it no fluff. He's no fluff. He's very direct, but with intentions. He's very intentional. And it's definitely something that I haven't had in my career to this point. And it's something that I would definitely write on my notepad, because I'm taking a little bit from each coach that I work for or play for, and I'm coming up with my own theories, you know. How would I, you know, if I was in this situation, I would do it this way, or I would do it like, you know, Billy Donovan, or I would do it like, you know, Scott Brooks, you know. So it's just like you're taking bits and pieces from everybody, but JV is definitely high character, high IQ, basketball mind, and he's definitely right to the point and, you know, what this team needed, you know. It's definitely different, but it's a breath of fresh air, and he's done a great job, you know, up until this point. It's definitely.
And what I admire about him too is that I think, you know, I'm sure his theories and the technical expertise has grown over the years, but I knew him when he was playing for the Nets, and now I deal with him every day before a game. He's the same guy. He's the same person. You know what I mean? He hasn't become like this joke coach, or he hasn't changed. I think that's a lesson for anybody that goes, you know, into this business.
Be authentically you. Be organically you. Like, I can't be JV. I can take some of his philosophies, but I can spin them my way. And that's what he's learned to do. You know, he worked for Pop, and he takes some of the nuances of the Popism, but he makes it the JVism. So be authentically you, do it the way you see it fit. And like, that's what makes him so great. Like, the way he delivers everything is him. It's, he's not being outside himself. So
yeah,
that takes a lot of humility.
What is ultimately, what are some of the goals you have besides just winning the next game and working with the players now? I would imagine you want to be a head coach at some point. Would you like to do that on the college level? Would you like to do it in the NBA level?
You know, I actually got a few reps, you know, with South Sudan.
By the way, I think they're 8-1. I think you're in a position to qualify, right, for the 23 World Cup.
Yeah, we're one game away from qualifying. The window is next February, play against Senegal, Congo, who had Jonathan Kuminga this summer. We beat them. Egypt, who's a tough team. So if we win one out of the three games, we qualify to go to the World Cups in Japan, I think Philippines, and
that
Indonesia.
Would be unbelievable. That would be incredible.
First time for the country. It's definitely been a learning experience. It's definitely been a joyous experience. It's definitely been a humbling experience being in that seat and just learning on the fly. Is head coach in my future? Who knows? I'm gonna just play it out and let the chips fall where they may. You know, before I was hiding from that kind of title, but now I'm open, you know, towards, if it's an opportunity for me to sit in that seat, then I'm gonna do my best and do my due diligence. So we'll see.
I would imagine that, you know, you mentioned though playing with South Sudan. I almost feel like that's the next, like they're going to be world power in basketball start to come out of that continent, because I think it's just been, they haven't had maybe the resources, and you're seeing now the NBA playing these Africa games, and there was a Paris game recently, and Adam Silver talked with President Macron from France, and they included how they were going to support teams in Africa and NBA Africa. And I almost feel like we're really close, maybe one great player or two away on one of these countries that puts them into the world power, kind of the way, you know, what Luka did for Slovenia or, you know, something like that. I think we're really close to with that in Africa, aren't we?
We're very close. The resources are not there yet. You know, in South Sudan, the president just basically put in a pact to build facilities for the South Sudan national team, men and women. So we'll have the first facility. We'll have our own gyms. We'll have our own dorms. We'll have, you know, basically our own living quarters for these players. And these players are playing outside, you know, mind you, you know, with no facilities, no equipment, and the game is growing. You know, people are now seeing what Bobo can do. He's South Sudanese. You know, the Dinka tribe is one of the tallest, it's the tallest people in the world. So now, you know, you have this kind of talent coming out. It's incredible. Once we tap into this, it's going to be astounding, because it's a lot of talent out there in Africa that has been untapped, and now it's starting to, you know, be tapped into. It's going to be extraordinary.
How did you get hooked up coaching South Sudan?
Luol Deng, South Sudanese. We played in Blair together. Yeah, we have a good relationship. He was coaching. He's the president of the federation, and I reached out to him. We had dialogue, good communication, and he agreed that, you know, I was fit to coach the team. And then it just took off, you know, coaching in Afro baskets, and then in these couple windows, and we're putting together something special. Yeah. We're really putting together something special because the game is changing. You know, the game is being played at a different pace. You know, a lot of skillful players in Africa, and now we're moving it forward.
I saw Ball when he came in to Barclays Center this year. He just for Orlando. I mean, I've seen him over the years, and I didn't know if he would ever get to that level. He was electrifying.
He can do everything. He can put the ball on the floor. He can shoot. He can pass. He can defend.
That could be your guy, man. That could be your hub there. Yeah,
hopefully we qualify for the Olympics in 2024. So I'm putting that out in the universe, manifesting my destiny.
And you know, you see again how you going back to how we started talking in this interview about your relationships with people. I mean, think about the impact you had on Luol Deng comes back to you at this point in your career where he tabs you to coach South Sudan.
See, that's life. Relationships are everything. You know, yeah. I didn't know 25, I'm telling my age, but 20 years ago,
it's okay,
that Luol Deng and I will be friends to this day and building up this African powerhouse in South Sudan. Like, didn't know, but we put in time, we put in work together. We have a genuine relationship and we grew it. And, you know, you never know what your relationships will take you. You know, you always be kind to people, you know, and treat them with utmost respect and, you know, and help them. And Luol helped me. He used to get me up at 6 o'clock. I was a senior. He was a freshman. And I knew he was going to be an NBA pro because of his work ethic. And he was talented. But the fact that I wasn't getting up at 6 o'clock and I was 17 years old. He was 14 years old. He was waking up at 6 o'clock and he had that discipline. And that taught me that discipline at 17, you know, that you got to put in the work and to get the results. It doesn't just happen. And, so we built this great relationship and it fostered through the years. And now we're here, you know,
that's it. That's a great
helping
story.
Other people, but we're helping people. And this life is about service. Like what you do for others. Like we don't get to where we are by ourselves. People help us. So if I can service somebody and help them get to the next point, then I'm doing what I'm called upon to do. And that's prime. We don't get to where we get to in life by ourselves. That's number one.
I love that. When Jacques Vaughn won Coach of the Month the first month, he gave this analogy at his press conference. He said, it's like a friend texted him, it's like if you see a turtle. On top of a fence post, you know one thing.
He Somebody didn't get put there that by turtle himself. There. Yeah. Somebody put that turtle there.
Nobody lifted him up. Yeah, he went climbing the fence.
He wasn't climbing that fence for sure. Yeah, we all need help, man. We all need help.
And I end these things all the time by talking about one of the great college coaches and one of the great characters. And we've talked about coaching and we've talked about characters on the show here. Jim Balvano and the never give up, you know, ESPY speech that he had. I've always felt like that was important in my life to hear that kind of stuff. And that's something that I live by. But he had something we talked about living a full life. He said, every day you should do three things. You should live, you should laugh, you should cry, and you should think. The laugh part of it. What makes Royal Ivy laugh?
I'm always smiling. I'm the life of the party. So like I said, I used to dance. So, you know, in my primitive years, my early years, you know, I would always be dancing and, you know, starting a riot and, you know, just doing fun and quirky things. But I still kind of, you know, bust a move every once in a while, you know, to give people like, oh, I didn't know you could dance, you know, or do a little break move, you know.
Have you danced in front of the team?
Nah, I haven't danced in a while. It's been a while.
Maybe after this episode comes out, somebody might listen and may ask you to dance in front of the team.
I mean, but nowadays they don't dance. You know, I was break dancing. They, you know, they got all these kind of TikTok dances. So it's all like redundant. You do this move, and it's like kind of like choreographed. You know, I'm more of freestyle, free flowing dancer. Like, you know, just bust out a move, whatever I feel like doing. So
that makes you smile. You can watch somebody dance, or
it's enjoyment.
Put yourself in that mood. Yeah,
it's entertainment. So you know, I will always dance. So you know, I'm always cracking a joke. I'm pretty loud, and you know, I'm outspoken. So you know, I'm always cracking on somebody or
so you like to make people laugh. You like
I do.
To make people laugh. Yeah,
I do. I make people laugh. That's how that makes me going. That keeps me going.
Well, I know whenever laugh. I walk by you in an arena somewhere, you make me smile. So I appreciate that.
I appreciate it. It's ditto.
the cry part is not necessarily something sad that makes you cry, but have your emotions moved. What is it that gets you emotional?
Ooh.
Maybe it could be something, maybe a song you heard or a movie or a person that you talk to that can get you emotional.
My daughter has my heart. She's six. That's my why. That's my reason. You know, she's basically the girl version, the female version of myself. You know, when I look at her, I see me, you know, and she gets me emotional, you know, just seeing her grow into the person she is today. Just loving, full of love and, you know, full of hope. And, you know, that gets me emotional because, you know, I'm investing into another human being and trying to grow her the right way. So that gets me emotional, the day to day, just the interactions with my daughter.
I love that.
Because I co-parent, so it's a little bit different, and I don't always get to see my daughter. So, you know, the times I do spend with my daughter, it's just like I'm so thankful, but also yet she drives me. She motivates me. So my daughter's my true inspiration, and she's my emotional flicker. She can get me teary-eyed.
What's her name?
Her name is Lyric.
Lyric.
Yeah, Lyric Ella Ivy.
Oh, I love
we call
that.
Her Lily.
I love that name. You guys have such great names.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I got to keep it going.
By the way, I wanted to ask you this about the name. So after the movie Pulp Fiction came out, how many people say Royale with Cheese to you?
I got a lot of nicknames. So Royale with Cheese is definitely Dave Fizdale. Assistant GM with the, you know, Utah Jazz. He, you know, he was my player development coach in Atlanta, and I worked with him with the Knicks. He would always call me Cheese, you know, cause of that movie. So some people call me Cheese. Some people call me Smoke. Some people call me Roy. Like, I got all these nicknames.
For people that don't know, it was in Pulp Fiction, the John Travolta character just come back from Europe, and he say, "Oh, you know what they call a quarter pounder in France?
Metrics.
It's a Royale with cheese."
Yeah, a Royale with cheese. So one of my nicknames is Cheese to
that
stamp
sense.
That one.
I knew somebody had thought of that. And the think part was always if you know, there's the Oculus outside Barclays Center when you walk out of the subway station or you're walking into the arena for whatever event, how many tens of thousands of people will see this? And if you could put a message up there that you want everybody to think about, just something you want to get in people's heads, something that maybe means something to you or you want to pass along to think about. That's the think part. What do you think it would be?
If I can put something, my slogan,
anything. Slogan, a picture, a phrase, whatever you might want.
My quote would be, take nothing for granted, always be humble. Like, I'm privileged to be in this position, and this is temporary. This is not my position. I'm gone in this position for this period. And then I'm passing it along. Somebody else will hold this position. So I'm always grateful, and I show gratitude to what came before me and my present moment. And presently I'm in this position, but I know it's temporary, and I will pass it along. And that's what I will hold dear to people. Take nothing for granted. Always be humble.
Royale Ivy. That was fantastic. I really appreciate you doing this. Thanks so much, man.
I appreciate you having me on the show. Thanks a lot.
I've always liked Royal Ivy, and just the small times that I've talked to him over the last couple of years or whatever, but I like him so much more now that I've had this conversation with him, this hour-long conversation. Tom Dowd joining us right now, our producer. I know you're doing extensive work on this, Brooklyn basketball podcast, and he is an unlikely story, Tom, as far as, you know, great players that have played in the NBA out of Queens. There's certainly a lot bigger names that never had the kind of, the longevity of a career that Royal Ivy ended up having.
Yeah, he's a great guy to have on the show right now because, we're highlighting some Nets staff, but he also kind of ties into that New York basketball history, that Brooklyn basketball history we're talking about. And it's funny, when you look back at Brooklyn basketball in that era, because he graduates Cardozo in 99, and, Brooklyn high school hoops, it's kind of that period in between the Marbury era and the Telfair era at Lincoln. And around the city, you've got guys a couple years older than him. Lamar Odom comes out of Christ the King in 96. Ron Artest comes out of LaSalle in 97. And I'm covering a lot of high school basketball in New York City at that time. And yeah, there's a lot of guys with a lot of hype, and a lot of them went on to nice college careers, and maybe they played overseas. But this guy, who as a senior at Cardozo is getting recruited by the Northeast Conference and the MAC, he's the guy that goes on to a 10-year NBA career. And I think that tells you so much about the person.
Yeah, that's it. He's playing in the Final Four. And that 1 year of prep school, what it did for him and launched him from, like you said, getting recruited by NEC teams to end up at Texas and going and playing in the Final Four. And it could show you sometimes, what development means. And if you're not, his mother knowing that he wasn't mature enough to go to college at that point and then taking that extra year and what that could mean to somebody.
It's all that mix, right? Like he said, he's young for his class. He was 17. He's a guy who got a little bit of a late start because he was a guy who was interested in so many other different things. He talked about, maybe he was going to play baseball. And if he had gone that route, who knows? Maybe he's a Major League Baseball center fielder. I don't know. But he and his family knew the right thing was another year of development. And it just opened up a ton of doors for him.
It's inspiring and it's terrifying sometimes to think of the little small decisions you make and what it could lead to in your life.
The road taken, the road not taken for everybody. And it's funny when you look back at it, it's okay to think about those things, but you never want to, have regrets about those decisions or kind of waste too much time thinking about it.
Yeah, it could go the other way too. It can end up, you pause on something or you go in a different direction. It can end up being worse off for you. But really enjoyed talking to Royal Ivy. I think of, we always end these things in the post game show about things to watch and things to listen to that relate to the episode. I gave you the Ted Lasso thing in the beginning, but more along playing on the name Royal and Queens, I think of two things in the watch category. I think of when you're when you're a prince in Zamunda and you want to find a woman who is worthy of being a princess, where do you go? You go to Queens and Coming to America. That's one. And okay. I think of Doug Heffernan and Carrie Heffernan and the King of Queens, which I will say when people talk about their guilty pleasures, started during the pandemic. I discovered King of Queens on TV Land every night from 11. They play like six episodes in a row. And it has become then the thing that I watch for just a little mindless entertainment before I go to bed every night. Do you have any other things or do you have anything to add to that, TD?
I mean, if we're talking about Queens, growing up when you and I did, maybe the first show that pops into mind, and it's All in the Family, right?
Yeah. Archie was from Queens. Yeah.
My grandfather was a bit of an Archie Bunker. Even kind of looked like him.
and musically, I mean, I'm not even going to, you know, there was a band called Queen, obviously. Kings of Leon, which is a really good band. There's Lord, who had the song Royal, not Royale, but the song Royal. And I'll throw out a song recommendation for everybody. You know, I love Frank Turner. He has a song called God Save the Queen. I'm sorry, not God Save the Queen. God Save the Queen is the Sex Pistols album. Long yes. Live the Queen is the Frank Turner song.
Okay.
Which is not about the Queen, but it's a song. It's a poignant song. But anyway, we digress. Or how about Three Princes?
Which one's that?
Two Princes.
By the Spin Doctors.
Yes, the Spin Doctors. Yes, there you go.
I stumbled into a live show of the Spin Doctors like a couple years ago because they're still around, and they're actually still pretty good.
I was taken back one day. You know, sometimes you get a follower on Twitter. The lead singer for the Spin Doctors followed me on Twitter.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Chris something or other.
We were just going to a Brooklyn Bowl thing, me and some my Nets teammates in the marketing group. And, you know, I just kind of looked up at the poster and I see the Spin Doctors. And then I see that it's like that night's date. And I said to my guy, I said, the Spin Doctors playing here tonight? He said, I guess so.
You thought it was left up there from 1996?
I had no idea. Well, because I said to him, I said, I once saw the Spin Doctors like in a gym in Syracuse, New York in like 1990. And before I could finish, he's just like, stop talking. Don't mention the date. It was a long time ago.
Yeah.
But it was a fun little show.
TD, Tom Dow. Thanks, buddy. Thanks for setting this up. He's our producer. Isaac Lee's our engineer. I want to thank the great Royal Ivy for joining us. And also a part of Tom's upcoming series about Brooklyn basketball podcast. We'll touch on Royale. I think he was mentioned a couple of times, right?
And that, yeah, definitely.
All right. So coming up, we've got, you know, football Super Bowl coming up. Brian Baldinger is going to be joining us before the Super Bowl. His life and everything. And also we'll talk a little Super Bowl. Why not? Right before the big game, as we can say. Hopefully there's no cease and desist. We can't use the term. Thanks, Tom. Thanks, Isaac. Thanks, everybody. I'm Chris Carino. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe, and we'll talk to you next time on The Voice of the Nets.